but that's the old.
And AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you're having a great day today, whether you're listening live here Saturday afternoon on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620, or you're listening to the podcast version of this show wherever you get your podcasts, whenever your little heart desires. Either way, we're going to hope to make your day a little bit better by bringing you up to date with everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. And in order to do so, I am welcoming, as I do so very often on the show, our good friend Jeremy Branch.
Glad to be here. Very exciting. I kind of decided at the last minute to go see a movie last night, and I think you saw it as well. And the movie is Naked Gun. Obviously, this is kind of a legacy sequel in the way a lot of horror movies have done lately, but yeah, in a different context.
I mean, that's the best way to put it, because it's not a remake. It's, you know, I think that was like the initial, like, I was very skeptical about this movie. I'll be completely honest with you, Jeremy. I am a big fan of the Zucker Abrams Zucker comedies, in particular Airplane, which is probably my favorite movie. But Naked Gun is up there. I was a big fan of the Police Squad TV series that was the predecessor to it. Which I actually think is even better than the movies, but that's another story. And then they made three of these movies with Leslie Nielsen as Lieutenant Frank Drebin. And I'm glad that they did not go the route of just casting a new Frank Drebin, that this is Frank Drebin Jr. and this is Liam Neeson playing the son of Leslie Nielsen's character. Which is fun on multiple levels, because it's the similarity of the names Nielsen and Neeson is kind of fun. But, you know, for those that don't remember, that only remember Leslie Nielsen as a comedic actor, the reason Leslie Nielsen worked in these roles initially before he like decided, oh, I'm a comedy guy now, and started mugging at the camera, was that he was a serious dramatic actor and had been in things like Forbidden Planet and played like a lot of cops and things like that. So the humor was, especially in Airplane, in playing these characters straight while craziness went on around them. And so who better than Liam Neeson, who is like, has become the prototypical aging action movie star over the past, 20 years or so. Neeson's not really known for a lot of comedy. So it really works on that level. What did you think of the movie?
Okay, a little bit of context. Now I got to set it up. I didn't grow up like a hardcore fan of the spoof genre. I've seen all of the Naked Guns. I feel like Blazing Saddles kind of exists on its own little orbit. It's not quite the same kind of movie as what we're talking about here, Airplane, the Naked Gun movies. Later on, the Wayans brothers kind of carried the torch with the Scary Movie franchise.
Well, and again, that started
degrees of success, right?
That franchise started also with Zucker Abrams Zucker involved too. So, I mean, it is kind of very much, there is a style there. And they may have eventually gotten away from that style, but that style starts with, really, even before Airplane, with Kentucky Fried Movie, which
I've never seen that before.
Yeah, Kentucky Fried Movie is kind of an anthology film, but it is very much a kind of very sketchy kind of assemblage of comedic stuff. Airplane is actually basically a straightforward remake of a 1950s airplane disaster movie that they basically took whole elements. They licensed the screenplay and basically took whole elements of that screenplay and copy pasted them, but then made a bunch of jokes around it.
So I didn't have a bunch of expectations going into the movie, but I did want to laugh. You and I have talked often about the fact that when you look at best comedies at award shows, you're not seeing a lot of what you and I would consider like screwball comedies, the kind of comedies that we grew up on. They were almost seen of like as a passe thing, but I love that communal experience. I went to the movie and I had a blast with it, man. I don't want to spoil anything because it just now came out, but I do want to say that there's the scene involving the dash cam is one of the funniest gags I've seen. I was crying laughing.
There is some really good stuff in this. It's really funny. It's a little less rapid fire, I think, than the original movies. But there's a lot going on here, and it rewards paying attention. It rewards keeping an eye on what's going on in the background. There's multiple jokes going on at the same time. And, you know, it's interesting to mention because that's something that very much influenced The Simpsons, too.
Uh-huh.
Like I don't think we would have gotten The Simpsons, at least not in the form that we have it in and that we've had it in for what? How long has The Simpsons been on? 30 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. Without Zucker Abram Zucker and the original airplane and all of that. You know, all of that is very much it, the influence that it had on comedy is pretty indelible. And I'm glad to see someone taking that torch and running with it. Like, I was very skeptical about this movie. I shouldn't have been so skeptical. I should have realized, hey, this is Akiva Schaffer. This is, you know, the guy who, you know, if you don't know, he's part of the Lonely Island along with Andy Samberg and Jorma Taccone. They did all of those great SNL digital shorts that we loved so much back in the day. Then went on to do movies like Hot Rod and Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stopping. And another movie that is a million times better than it has any right to be, the Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers movie that they did.
It was really good.
Went to Disney Plus, won the Emmy Award for best television film that year, and absolutely deserved that. Movie is a lot of fun. It's very funny. It's very smart. And I think that's true of this movie, too.
Smart might be a little bit of a stretch. Simpsons has been out for 40 years. That'll make you feel old. Kind of crazy.
Well, here's the thing. It's dumb, but it takes a lot of smarts to be that dumb.
I totally agree.
There's a difference between, and I used to say this all the time, there's a difference between stupid, spelled S-T-U-P-I-D, and stupid, S-T-O-O-P-I-D.
Sure.
Yeah, like that so dumb it's smart thing. Like, I mean, like, I think that's part of the appeal of the Ramones, which I'm a massive Ramones fan. You know, that it seems simple. It seems very, you know, not a lot of thought went into it. But to make something that perfect and that simple takes a lot more smarts than you think it does. And I'm not saying this is a perfect movie. It's not. But it is a lot of fun. And you're going to have a lot of fun with it. And you don't come up with this by accident. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in this movie. There's a lot of fun allusions to the original movies too. Some of them are very obvious, like him being Frank Drebin Jr. and his partner is the son of his partner from the original movies, George Kennedy's character. There's you know things like that. You know there's a little cameo from Priscilla Presley, who was the love interest in the three films. Things like that.
I even copped a gratuitous beaver shot at one moment.
That was one of the ones I thought was really subtle that I really, really liked. When you walk into this bar and it's all full of taxidermied animals, but the first thing you see right in the middle of the screen is a beaver. That's a callback. That is absolutely a callback to the first Naked Gun. And I think I might have been the only one in my screening that got that, because I was definitely the only one that laughed at it.
But I thought that, okay, yeah, I wasn't 100% sure that I was even onto something with that, but I'm glad you caught it too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was absolutely, you know, that's one of the most iconic lines or bit of dialogue from the first film. You know, Priscilla Presley's up on a ladder pulling stuff out of the attic, and she's wearing a skirt, and Leslie Nielsen's looking up at her, and he says, "Nice beaver." And she says, "Thanks, I just had it stuffed." And then she pulls out a taxidermied beaver. Yeah. You know, it's super fun. You know, Neeson's great. Pamela Anderson's great in it.
Her little scat scene was so fun. I felt like she was really enjoying herself.
Yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. I think you're going to have a good time with it. And I hope that this leads to a renaissance for comedy at the theaters, because we're missing these kinds of big comedies in theatrical release. They're all going to streaming, and I think we need them in theaters. We've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we are going to devote the rest of the show to talking about the new movie, Fantastic Four First Steps, which just came out.
Oh, crap, Julio, I didn't see it.
Jeremy's going to sit back and listen to me talk about... I think you saw it before I did. Who are you kidding? I was out of town, so I didn't get to see it until just a couple of days ago. But I'm guessing you saw it Thursday or Friday of last week.
I did. I'm so excited to talk about it. I had to throw that in there because wouldn't that be wild? But yeah, I'm stoked.
I mean, it would be funny. we're gonna have some fun with the music this week too, because this film takes place in on an alternate world from our world, but in 1965. So we're gonna play that. That was the number one song of the year 1965. Believe it or not,
right.
"Wooly Bully" by Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. Crazy enough that you know, in a year that had, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Four Tops and, you know, you name it. I mean, the Temptations, the Beach Boys, you know, some all-time greats. You had, I'm pretty sure it was a one-hit wonder with Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe they may have had another hit or two, but I think that was the big one, obviously.
What's crazy about that is I thought that song was a cover of the Little Caesars Pizza Pizza song. I guess my timeline's messed up.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? You get into the multiverse and things happen.
Yeah, true.
So let's get into it. This is a film taking place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. However, it is, as we are, you know, starting to wind down on the multiverse saga, this takes place on a different world than the other worlds that the other films that we've seen. Pretty much every film we've seen, other than like where there's been some universe hopping and things like Loki and Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, has been on Earth 626. This film takes place on Earth 828. It says it right there at the beginning of the movie. And as we find out at the end of the movie, if you stay all the way through the credits and everything, there's a reason it's given that designation. That is because the Fantastic Four and pretty much most, if not all, of the major Marvel Universe characters from the 60s and into the early 70s were co-created by a man named Jack Kirby. You know, I think people tend to put a lot of credit on Stan Lee, and I'm not trying to take any credit away from Stan Lee, but Jack Kirby is, you know, not just an artist. He is kind of the architect of the Marvel Universe. And the Fantastic Four were as much, if not more, his creation than Stan Lee's. And they were, you know, the Fantastic Four were, there's a reason they call them Marvel's first family. They were literally the first comic book as Marvel Comics. There had been, you know, predecessor companies that, you know, some of that stuff is carried over, like Captain America, you know, Namor, the original version of the Human Torch. They date back to Timely Comics, was the original publisher. And there was a comic book called Marvel Comics, but the publisher was not called Marvel Comics. It was Timely, and then they became Atlas for a while in the 50s. And in 1961, when the first issue of Fantastic Four dropped, that's when they became Marvel Comics. And that book set the prototype for Marvel's brand of superheroes and their kind of characterization and their idea that the world they lived in was the world outside our window, and that these were regular people that happen to have superpowers and not the, you know, more like, for the time, for DC at the time, their heroes were very much the, kind of like the, like, people want to call them gods, but I think of them more like babyface professional wrestlers.
Mm.
Like, you know, eat your greens, little young man, and go to school, you know. These, you know, meanwhile, you know, the Human Torch and the Thing are, you know, throwing stuff at each other and screaming at each other. You know, they're real people. They had real problems. They, you know, they wouldn't always get along, but they'd, you know, come together and do what they had to do.
They were set in New York City, no Metropolis. It was the real world. These characters were more relatable to some because they were grounded in our reality and had problems that everyday people could identify with.
Right. And of course, you know, these people would have an effect on the world around them because, you know, of course they would. So the world diverges in that way. But, you know, you're not having a whole lot of there's some made up places, but not as many as like there are in the DC universe, that sort of thing. And I think that this world that we see in this movie, in because this film is set in 1965, in a world where the Fantastic Four have been around for 4 years, that's stated up front right at the very beginning, and because you have these four, you know, top scientists who then became superpowered and became not just the protectors of the world, but kind of celebrities and very influential figures, and that come up with all these genius inventions, the world looks differently than our world did in 1965 in that very retro-futuristic style. And I think that's like the first thing I want to talk about this movie, because that I think is kind of key. This aesthetic, this design aesthetic, this very like Jetsons-y kind of view of the future, but done in a modern day is kind of one of the first key things about this movie, don't you think?
Absolutely. I point to, and this is because I'm a layman, but I point to artists like Sid Mead, who was very pivotal in designing worlds for like Star Wars and Blade Runner. And he was the Hollywood guy that did the retrofuturism style, though artists did that stuff that predates it. And it was what Julio's saying. It's kind of like what the world would look like in the 2000s through the lens of somebody existing during the 1960s. So if you think about the design of Tomorrowland in the Magic Kingdom, mm-hmm. that's kind of the aesthetic. And yes, it's striking for that reason. If you think about the TVA in Loki, that aesthetic is kind of a reference point, a starting point to how they developed this world outward from that. Also early episodes of WandaVision. So like, yeah, the aesthetic is immediately striking and immediately gives this movie like a singular voice and style that sets it apart, even though we have seen elements of that in other stuff. It's so fully realized here that it's like the world building is awesome.
I'd go so far as to say that it's even a little more retro than anything we see in Loki, though, because Loki feels very 70s to me.
Sure.
And this definitely feels like a 60s future. It's mm-hmm. it's not a 1950s future, which is a little bit different too, but it is very much like. And we should mention, you mentioned WandaVision. This is directed by Matt Shakman, who directed all of WandaVision, and brings some of that same kind of flair to it. And WandaVision is a show that took place in several different time periods. And so he does have that experience with, you know, if you remember, the first two episodes of WandaVision were very much a 1960s era. You know, you had that first one in the black and white kind of Dick Van Dyke-ish kind of era, and then the second one was more of like a Bewitched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up watching that stuff in reruns, and I love that stuff. So, that kind of aesthetic has a lot of appeal for me. So I really enjoyed that element. I really enjoyed seeing what, especially having a Reed Richards, and it's not just Reed, because all four... One of the few little tweaks they make to these characters from the comic books is all four of them are scientists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while Reed is brilliant on another level beyond anybody else, which he always had, Reed Richards should be, if not the smartest, then one of the smartest people in the Marvel Universe, probably the smartest. They put Sue and Ben and Johnny on a little more level intellectual playing field with him than they sometimes have been in the comics, which is something I really liked. You know, one of the things that never made sense about the original Fantastic Four origin was, hey, we're going to go into space and I'm going to take my college buddy who's a great pilot. Okay, that makes sense. Ben Grimm, great pilot. Need a great pilot to pilot this spacecraft. And I'm also going to bring my girlfriend and her kid brother.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, are, you know, her kid brother was like 17, 16 or something. And her, you know, his girlfriend was not like a scientist or anything. It's like, why are they there?
Yeah. They make it make sense. And also along with the 60s aesthetic, I think comes this 60s idealism and kind of hopefulness in the future of space exploration, which I thought was really cool. It does harken to early era NASA space exploration, and we'll get into, you know, more specific stuff as we go along. But I think to speak to the aesthetic part of it, there is a optimism that fits perfectly in that era, that like it feels good in a contemporary setting where things have been divisive for a long time. But in this world, in this timeline, the people have essentially all come together and all look at the Fantastic Four, as you mentioned, as like they're heroes, and they're the only ones in this reality, which is also cool because it kind of resets the board. But I really like that feeling of like optimism that is the through line throughout it.
Well, and again, that's kind of the core of who the Fantastic Four are too. That's kind of the genesis of these characters in the comics. It was very much the origin of the Fantastic Four was tied to the space race, and it was very much a we've got to beat the Russians to the moon.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And that's that is why the Fantastic Four became the Fantastic Four. They took this rocket into space, and they were not shielded from the cosmic radiation. The cosmic radiation is what gave them their powers. There's, you know, even some further allusion to that in the film, which, you know, there's a brief mention of some characters who the Red Ghost and the Super Apes, who were basically the Russian version, you know. So, I mean, that goes a lot to the core of these characters. That's what I want to talk about when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line. And man, I always just want to let that song keep playing. I love the Four Tops. That's my favorite Motown group. Such a great song.
It's an incredible song.
Yeah, such a great song. We are talking about Fantastic Four First Steps. In case you're wondering why we're heading back to the 60s with the music, it's because this movie is set in 1965. So makes some sense there. But the thing I wanted to get to, Jeremy, here, because we talked a lot in the last segment about the design aesthetic and about the time period and how all of that is essential to these characters. And I think the reason I love this movie as much as I do, and I love it a lot, is because we've seen a few attempts at bringing the Fantastic Four to the big screen before, to varying levels of quality, varying somewhere between pretty decent to absolute cinematic. I want to say disaster, I guess. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best word for the Fant Four Stick film.
Uh-huh.
But I mean that's a thing that happened. We'd like to forget that it happened, but that's a thing that happened. This is the first time where I've felt like they really got to the core of who these characters are. And I think I say that with a little bit of a caveat. Like the problems with especially the two Tim Story films are not necessarily the actors. I don't think the actors were necessarily bad. Maybe slightly miscast in one or two cases, but I think in particular, Chris Evans as the Human Torch was really good, and Michael Chiklis as the Thing was really good. But this is the first time where I feel like all four characters, we have the core of who these characters are. They felt like the characters they are in the comics. And they felt, I like that this world is lived in. They've been around for a while. They have gelled their family. They should be. And to the extent too that as much as we see Pedro Pascal, I mean, he's almost on the verge as being as overexposed as Sidney Sweeney, which is saying something. Because Sidney Sweeney, you can't go get ice cream without seeing Sidney Sweeney now. It's actually gotten to almost an overload point, but I digress. Pedro is out there almost as much, and he plays a lot of things, and a lot of times it can be hard to see the character that you're just seeing Pedro. I don't think that's the case in Last of Us or Mandalorian, but maybe some of the other things, like what was the film that the other film that he was in last month?
Materialist.
Yeah, you know, he felt very Pedro in that. The same with the
Eddington.
Yeah, Eddington. I saw both of these movies, and you can tell how well they're sticking out in my memory. In this, I tended to forget that I was watching Pedro.
He does something really specific, and I loved it, man. I feel like everything you're saying resonates with me, and I was never concerned about the way that the character looked. I'm not somebody that gets super hung up on that stuff to the point that I didn't even care if Joseph Quinn was blonde and had blue eyes or anything like that. But I do feel like in a world with so many super geniuses and so many smartest men in the world, which is a serious Marvel trope, he needed to bring specificity, and he did not feel like Tony Stark, and he did not feel like Stephen Strange. There was a very specific choice that made him, I think this was the best performance in the movie. And that's like a testament to the fact that like he was able to bring something to it.
Well, here's the difference between Reed Richards and Tony Stark, for an example. Reed Richards is not a playboy. Reed Richards is somebody who has a massive intellect, but he bears the weight of that intellect.
Mm-hmm.
He is not a breezy guy. He is somebody that takes that intellect very seriously, and he can be a little bit of the absent-minded professor and get absorbed in the work. And he can, you know, be kind of reserved in that way that geniuses can be, but it's because he feels like he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. And, you know, that's something that he basically outright says in this film. And that in and of itself, that little characterization, there's so much going on with Pedro's depiction of Reed that's kind of going on behind the eyes. It's not verbal. It's not things that he's saying. It's things that he's conveying through his actions and through his expressions. And it's a really good performance.
And I think that can be said about other characters in the movie as well. Like,
definitely
a lot of nonverbal communication between the team that like, it does a good job of conveying their relationship without saying the quiet part out loud. There's not a bunch of like on the nose dialogue, but like you can feel their connections and the way that they all relate to each other in that same kind of thing behind the eyes that you were just talking about. And I think that's like a real testament to a movie that like historically Marvel has been really broad in some ways. And I feel like they didn't have to be so broad in this one.
No, it feels like a family, and then that's the way a family communicates. That shorthand develops to where things don't have to be said.
Yep.
And you get to know these characters enough that you can see that happening. I think all four of the leads here are just outstanding. And I think that the flip side of it, what you run into is the possibility of one of the four dominating over the other three. And I think if that happens at all, it's Vanessa Kirby's Sue Storm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it really happens, but I think she comes the closest to dominating, especially at the climax of this film. She is the one that proves that she is, as much as the Thing is the rocky guy, she's the rock of the Fantastic Four. She's the core. She's the one that's holding them all together, and she's actually the most powerful of the four. And again, this is a depiction that maybe not at the very start of the comics, because, you know, when these comics were developed initially, you know, that wasn't the gender roles, you know, but as the character has developed over time, that has become the way Sue Storm has been depicted in the comics. And I'm glad they went that route. One thing I think that does change about this film compared to the actual 1960s is things like the gender roles and the racial equality. We do see, you know, some Black people in positions of prominence. We see some Asian people, things like that. Ben Grimm is Jewish. They make no bones about that, where that's something that wasn't really acknowledged in the comics for a long time. We see that pretty much on his sleeve. He goes, you know, he becomes interested in this girl that teaches at a Hebrew school and goes to see her at the synagogue. But Vanessa Kirby is so good. I mean, everybody is so good in this, but Vanessa Kirby just really knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was eager to see characterizations from actors that I'm like a big fan of. Like, I wanted to see what Eben Moss Bachrach would do with the Thing. That was one that I was particularly excited in, and I do think he did an excellent job. What I wasn't expecting was to come out of it being like, yeah, she was definitely the MVP of the story. And again, in a movie full of just really good characterizations, something that we haven't touched on yet is kind of the villains of the movie, for oversimplification's sake. But yeah, I think that just all the way through the casting, they did a really good job. And this isn't a movie that relies heavily on the big action set pieces either. And I could see how some people might have wanted to see more of those like showcase reels of the superhero's powers. But like you said, Reed's ultimate power is his intellect, and the team is smart. And a lot of the big action sequences aren't just like beat 'em up scenes. And I love one in particular, the space scene. So.
Oh yeah, the whole space sequence in the second act of the film, where they're basically trying to escape from the surfer and Galactus while Sue's in the middle of giving birth, is it's the centerpiece of the film.
Wild.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's got these incredible visuals. I can't say enough good things about that particular part of the film. The whole film, I think, really does shine. We really do. We spend some time with these characters too. For a movie that is actually relatively on the short side, it's a little under, just a shade under 2 hours long. We spend more than a year with these characters, and we really feel like we get to know them and we get to know this world, even though it's a fairly compact film, a fairly efficient film in that regard. The Surfer and Galactus were great. You know, Galactus is a little unknowable, but he should be. But we'll talk more about that when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we are talking about Fantastic Four First Steps. And we started getting into the whole of Galactus and the Silver Surfer, who are the antagonists. Let's say antagonists rather than villains, don't you think?
Sure.
Like, yeah. I don't think that there are necessarily villains in this film. There's not like some nefarious plot to commit some great evil. It's Galactus is presented as a force of nature, which is what the character is. You know, that it's, you know, there's a reason for Galactus to exist in the universe. And that they very much make that clear in the film. And while they don't want to give up the Earth or give up, they're presented with this choice that, you know, that Galactus will spare the Earth if they give him their child, because their child has the potential to be the next Galactus. And Galactus would like to rest. He would like to no longer have to go out and devour worlds and cause all of this destruction. This is, again, stuff that's straight out of the comics. Of course, you know, what parents of a new baby are going to say, yes, take our baby and spare the world. You know, it's a very human, you know, you can't make that choice. You just can't. Yeah, maybe you can, and this is something that they play out in the movie, you know, where the world sees them as selfish because they tell the world this is what they did. But you're not thinking beyond that perspective. And Sue gets to give a great speech at about the 2/3 mark in the movie that brings the world over to their side. But Galactus isn't necessarily evil. He's just performing a task that he has to perform. The Surfer
as is the Herald.
Yeah, the Surfer is the Herald. And of course, it comes out in the course of the film that the Surfer became the Herald to Galactus in order to spare her world. This is, again, straight out of the comics. Now, there was a lot of controversy pre the film coming out, because traditionally the character that her name has gone straight out of my head. Julia Garner. Is that it? Yeah. Julia Garner. She plays a character named Shala Ball, who becomes the Silver Surfer. There is history in the multiverse of Marvel Comics for Shala Ball to become the Surfer. However, in the mainline universe, the Silver Surfer is male and is Norrin Radd, and Shala Ball was his love interest. She was kind of the leader of the world, and he was kind of the head scientist of the world. And he's the one that makes the sacrifice to become the Herald and go off to, in order to spare their world of Zen Law. However, there are alternate universes in which Shala Ball is the one who made that sacrifice. And so this world takes place in a universe where Shala Ball is the one who becomes the Surfer. And we actually don't ever see Norrin Radd in this movie at all. But I think one of the reasons they chose to do this is because we wanted to see, in the course of the story, Shala Ball relate to the humanity in protecting a child. Because we see that Shala Ball, in a flashback sequence, we see that she had a child. And I think that's part of the key as to why the Surfer turns against Galactus and ends up aiding the Fantastic Four. In the original comics, it was, you know, the Surfer discovering the nobility of humanity and, you know, being awakened to, you know, all of this. And I think they played on that really well. And I think Johnny, the interesting arc for Johnny in this is, you know, him kind of crushing on her, and that leading him to become interested in what she was saying in her own language and decoding that language to then, you know, find out about her history and kind of using it against her. Like, even though he was crushing on her, he was also trying to do the right thing. Like, it wasn't just, oh, I'm interested in her because she's, you know, a hot naked girl on a surfboard. It was, you know, he applied that. He applied what he learned. It's like, how many worlds did you lead to destruction? And do you remember the people of this world and this world and this world? And, you know, because he learned all of that from decoding her language.
Yeah. I can't say what the reason for them choosing to do a female Surfer was, but I can say whatever the reason, they more than justified it with the things that you're saying right now. And it gave Johnny an opportunity to be that side of Johnny that people kind of, I think, recognize from media, which is that he's kind of a ladies' man. And I think, to your point, which is a really good one, I hadn't really thought about, but the parallel between Sue being a mother and her being a mother. Mm. Also, I think just broadly speaking, it's a movie about empathy. And by learning to speak somebody else's language and meeting them where they're at, I don't think that Johnny was trying to get over on her as much as I think he was just merely trying to communicate with her. And by having the ability to speak her language, it allowed her to be able to empathize with them even further. So like I feel like thematically, ultimately, it's really about empathy. And I know that that even has become politicized. I mean, there's a controversy about everything, but for whatever reason, they decided to use Julie Garner as the surfer. I don't think this movie would have worked near as well as it did with a male Harold in it. So yeah. I think they nailed it.
I think just going back to what you were saying about Johnny being the ladies' man, I think they allowed him to have a little bit of that flavor without it being gross.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I mean, if you go back and as good as I think Chris Evans was, some of that depiction's a little dated now.
And
a little gross now. And it's not anything that Chris Evans did wrong. It's how the character was written. And it is how the character was written in the comics for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not an inaccurate depiction, but it is a depiction that is not as attractive today as it was, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. That, you know, just our standards have changed. And mm-hmm. it's good that they've, you know, much as our standards for, you know, Sue have changed, and, you know, it was okay for her to just be the girlfriend and kind of flighty originally, but that's not okay anymore. And, or, I mean, not that it's not okay, but it's not as acceptable.
Yeah.
It is not as heroic. It's not considered as heroic as a character like the way she is depicted now is considered.
And back to that thing about empathy is like, if the audience was solely meant for men, then maybe it would be a different conversation. But the idea is people see themselves in these characters. They see that that thing is a Jewish man and they connect with that and empathy. People are mothers and they see this mother having to make this choice and they empathize with that. So like by giving everybody, not everybody, but trying to give as many people an access point as possible, I think is really, really important to movie making and us not centering ourselves in the conversation and kind of gatekeeping who these are for, I think is good. And not just like in the progressive, political way, but just thinking about it from outside of ourselves for a moment and saying, if you took your daughter to see Fantastic Four, wouldn't you want those depictions to be people that she thought were heroic and that she could find aspirational, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, do you want your child to aspire to be a scientist and a diplomat and a mother and, you know, this inspirational person, or do you want her to aspire to be, you know, an influencer or something?
Yeah, right.
Because... frankly, like that's kind of, you know, the influencer wasn't a term then, but like Sue originally wanted to be an actress and she was like kind of like the den mother. And it's like, that's fine. You know, if that's what you want to do with your life, that's fine. But is that necessarily inspirational?
Yeah, totally.
Your mileage may vary, of course, but, you know, I would like to see people aspire to be more than that. You know, maybe it's because I'm not making, you know, a couple mil off of YouTube a year or whatever, but, you know, very, very few people are. So it's actually more realistic to have a rewarding career in science than it is to have a rewarding career in streaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like the one character we haven't talked that much about yet is The Thing, which is interesting because The Thing is one of my favorite characters in Marvel Comics. I do think we get to see quite a bit of him. I think one thing that people have kind of pegged here a little bit is that maybe he's not quite as angry as he is in the comics about his fate of being, you know, trapped in this rocky body. But I feel like, again, this is, you know, we've had, he's been around for a while. He's had some time to get used to it. And he revels in being able to do good for people. He revels in being a hero, and, you know, the kind of like has a big heart for the kids. And I think that all of that really works for Ben. That
feels, you can feel it. It's internalized. And like you said, he's had a little bit of time to adjust to it at this point. But I do feel that he's not devoid of the pain that it would cost, because in a way he did pay the highest price. Everybody else still looks like $1 million, and he's a rock monster. And you can feel a little bit of that, the way that it affects him in it, but it's not screamed out in bold font throughout the whole movie. So I think it works.
Again, there's some great nonverbal stuff here that goes on with that character in particular. We're out of time, but I think it's fair to say we both love this movie. Go check it out.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk more about superhero movies next week for sure. But we got to go for now. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.